Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Thank you for joining me for today's SMIE Consulting Midweek Roundup for February 24th, 2021. I'm your host, Marty Bennett, and today on the Roundup, we're going to be answering three questions we've been hearing from international educators the last few days and going in depth into those questions and providing some context for how these questions and the answers might impact what we do in international education. It's been an interesting week all the way around with news of immigration legislation being released by the Biden administration through their surrogates in the House of Representatives. We'll talk about that. We're going to talk about international graduate school numbers from last fall and the importance of planning. And we're going to talk about all those in a few minutes, but I do want to give a special shout out to those watching live here on Facebook. Always a pleasure to have you along for the ride as we discuss these important issues of the day. Also, those who are finding the time to watch on repeat on either our Facebook page or our YouTube channel for SMIE Consulting, really appreciate you taking the time out of your week to make us a part of your journey professionally. And also those listening on podcast, it's great to have you along for the ride and listening in and hearing what we have to say that might help inform what you do in your work every day. So thanks again for being with us. Today, let's start with some good news. I mean, really, who doesn't want to hear positive immigration news from the administration? And we've certainly got that. It's been made concrete in their upcoming legislation that's been proposed by two members of Congress, actually Senator Bob Menendez from New Jersey and Linda Sanchez from California introduced their what they're calling the U.S. Citizenship Act of 2021. It's their sweeping immigration reform bill. And I'm dropping the link into the actual legislation that's been proposed and the commentary around it from the individuals, Senator Menendez and Representative Sanchez, to how their thoughts are on it. But obviously, it includes a lot that's not international ed specific, so I'm boil it down to the essential chunks of what we see in the legislation that has some really fantastic opportunities and includes some proposals that have been in the works and have been great ideas that have been discussed before but have never survived the legislative process. And we'll talk about what that might look like. So there are essentially four elements that have been in this immigration proposal bill that will directly impact what we do in international education and in a very positive way. The first up is the concept of extending dual intent to international students for F1 students. For those who work in international admissions, you're aware of this, that students that when they apply for their visas and go for their consular appointments to meet with a U.S. consular official, they have to basically demonstrate that they do not intend to immigrate to the United States because the F1 visa is by category a non-immigrant visa. So they have to prove a negative, really, in an interview. And as a 17, 18-year-old, that's not exactly the easiest thing in the world to do. And when to predict what you're going to be doing 4, 5, 6, 7 years out into the future and how that future is back in your home country. And that is really the challenge and has been the challenge for international students for decades in terms of how they approach the visa interview. It's been an essential element in that. So if there were a change to how the visa category of for students would become more of a dual intent category, could be either a non-immigrant or an immigrant intent, then that would simplify the admissions process on the visa side for students immeasurably, where that becomes less of a barrier to entry into the United States if students do not have to worry about saying, yeah, I plan to come home, or I've got ties to my home country, which are one of the significant barriers that have to be overcome or satisfied in the eyes of consular official. So this is a big deal. I mean, this partially comes out of the need for this extending dual intent from some language from 2007 in the waning years of the Bush administration, Bush 42 or 43, well, anyway, Bush 43, that this that Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State at the time, proposed that for consular officers to view students putting less emphasis on the non-immigrant intent piece, so the 214B, which is often used as a reason to deny students, saying that, well, they never plan to come home, and to put less focus on that in the interview and the decision-making process, the adjudication process, as they say. So that's certainly a bit of very positive news if that were to survive the legislation slated process and immigration reform becomes reality. Again, we're miles away from that actually happening, but these are some things that have some generally bipartisan support. There are some more sticky components in the legislation that will cause some partisan divides, so we'll see if all of these things survive that are directly impacting international ed. The second piece is regarding STEM PhD graduates, that they would be exempted from the annual green card cap, per country cap, that exists, that provides that direct path to basically providing a direct path to green card status, which is encouraging. And that's been something, has been an idea that's floated around. I mean, it's been called before stapling a green card to every PhD graduate from overseas that graduates in the United States. So that's certainly, if this happens, it's going to be huge as a promotional tool for U.S. higher education as well, in terms of those that are looking to come and potentially stay for work and to become even eventually permanent residents and citizens. That's a huge leap forward. Rather than the contrived go for OPT, then for H-1B, and then to apply, be able to apply for permanent residency through the company that you're working for. That is a very different process than we have currently. This new process would be very different than what we currently have. So if it happens, it's going to be enormous benefit. And as a promotional tool for U.S. higher education, it's going to be huge. It's going to put us not quite on the level of Canada, which makes it for all levels of study, from post-secondary study, including vocational and community colleges, that can have this path to work, study to work, clearly defined from the beginning as an immigrant intent category in their immigration system. In the U.S., this would pave the way for those that are looking at advanced degrees, particularly doctoral degrees, that pathway to green card status by simply coming and finishing a PhD here, which is enormous benefit. To future students internationally. The other piece is that it does enable international students to apply for green cards without losing their ability to extend their F1 status. And that is, and particularly given the delays that have been happening with OPT and other adjudication processes related to the benefits of non-immigrant students, this is a real challenging time. And there's lawsuits that are actually pending regarding OPT delays and these kinds of things. So this would enable students to extend their time without losing status, to extend their time in terms of applying for green cards, particularly those that are at the PhD category. It also allows international students, along with H-1Bs, a few other non-immigrant statuses as well, to extend their statuses in one-year increments while Department of Labor or USCIS are in the adjudicating their different the filings that they have made for green card status. So those are, three of them are obviously for end of the student funnel, student life cycle in the United States, experiences related to green cards and STEM and all that, STEM PhD students. That is something that, though it's at the end of the process, it very much would have front-end implications and benefits as institutions begin to start talking about international education opportunities in the United States and admissions and benefits of studying in the U.S. And that's frankly something we should be doing anyway in terms of talking about the benefits of study in the USA because as we talked about before, about when we're talking about having perspective as we go approach our planning for international recruitment, is before you develop those plans, is you have to be aware of what the playing field looks like. How are our competition doing this in terms of how they're approaching international student recruitment in their countries, and how are we competitively or not compared to those other countries? So this is something I think the more we can have this kind of language and documented legislation, if it were to go through. Again, it's a big if, a lot of miles to go before we sleep on this one. But this is something that can have significant consequences for years to come, positive consequences, which is nice to be able to say that if it were to be approved. So we'll keep you posted on developments there. Certainly going to be big news whenever, when and if it does happen for any of these pieces. But we'll certainly let you know where we are with these developments in Congress. Now, next up, our next question of the day is one that related to our first topic, in fact, is graduate enrollments in the United States. How bad were international grad admissions numbers last fall? And we already had a larger sense from the IIE snapshot survey from the fall that was released during IEW that there was a 43% drop in new international enrollments in the fall, and that was from a snapshot of 700 universities and colleges that enrolled a significant percentage of international students. And those were seen to be largely reflective of the numbers we were seeing. We saw also numbers that were from National Center for Enrollment Statistics that released data in the fall about overall numbers being 16% down. So in terms of international populations overall, not just the new ones. So we already kind of knew this was coming, but when you look at some of the other stories we've covered recently about graduate programs deciding to stop admissions for the next cycle or two, for many of those programs, either for declining enrollment reasons or in some cases losing 90% of your new students every year that would have been international in a year, that's a significant dent in your institutional revenue. So the new graduate numbers overall, that was CGS, Council of Graduate Schools survey that was released, new graduate numbers fell, international graduate numbers fell 40%, or 39% actually, in the fall of 2020. So the numbers had risen modestly before the outbreak, application numbers had, but the enrollment numbers were down significantly. And what often gets forgotten in this entire mess of enrollment numbers being down and how badly affected the United States was by coronavirus in terms of a lot of the blame being placed on the Trump administration, which is there's a certain percentage of it that would have shown up earlier in terms of, frankly, lower applications. So I think what we saw as a result this fall was cannot be laid solely on the foot of the Trump administration. They didn't help, but certainly the reasons why we didn't have significant enrollments this fall, past fall 2020 from internationals, we've talked about this before, is down to, frankly, the lack of U.S. consulates and embassies that were open for business, even for emergency appointments, which many are doing now. But many were not open for business for students to apply for visas. Even if they wanted to come, they couldn't. So that's the real rub here in this issue. And so it is a blip, frankly, in the nadir, frankly, of international education in the United States. It's about as low as we could go, conceivably, in the bigger scheme of things in the 100-year history of international students coming to the United States. This is something that they've been coming for longer than 100 years, but for the recorded numbers that IIE has been tracking. And we see with this report from CGS that for graduate programs, the lack of international students had a more significant impact because for many programs in, particularly STEM programs in graduate schools, international students make up a huge bulk of that. And the largest drops come from the two countries that, no surprise, China and India, that make up the largest percentage of well over half of all international graduate students in the United States are from those two countries. And some of those losses were more than 50% in those STEM science and engineering graduate programs. So There's going to be a bounce back this year, no doubt about that. I think application numbers will rebound. Enrollment numbers will certainly go up. They can't go any lower, frankly. And the doors will be open as more embassies reopen and consulates reopen for regular service, particularly in the summer months when the greater majority of international students that come each year will go for their visa appointments, June, July, and August. And that will give us a much better reflection of where we are as a country in terms of our overall trends. If we see a 2020 blip and we are on back on an upward trend for 2021 and beyond, I think that's going to certainly those numbers are going to certainly be more revealing. I have no doubt they'll be better than can't get worse than what it was last fall. But when you look at some of the issues related to graduate enrollment here, and we've talked about the STEM issues, we look at trends we've seen over the last 4 or 5 years, actually, frankly, ever since STEM OPT was introduced in 2008, when the extra 2 years of optional practical training were added in for students that were in these STEM programs. You saw a number of business schools making moves to go towards reclassifying some of their more statistical-related master's programs within business colleges, MBA programs, to be STEM and to change their classifications. And my ISSS friends know the SIP codes that we have to have that our Department of Education SIP codes that have to be when we are classifying students for, particularly international students for graduate programs or any academic program. If it's not a SIP code that's recognized by Department of Education as STEM, those students will not get the benefit of the extra 2 years of work experience. So the STEM OPT matters, and we've seen a lot of business colleges, particularly the more elite business schools, making shifts in how they classify their programs, their business programs, to capture this incredible extra 2 years of attractiveness of a U.S. higher education. So clearly there are some business programs, graduate school business programs, that see the value in recategorizing some of their analytic programs into STEM programs and making more of that as a focus of all of their business degrees to get that extra 2 years of benefit, because they understand business schools, marketing, know how to market, most of them do. And this is a value that they see to attract new classes to their campuses, to their programs. So we're going to see more of this. But interestingly, there's a Poets and Quants, which is more of a student-facing site for particularly MBA programs. They recently surveyed non-STEM MBA programs that whether they would be considering the move to become reclassify as STEM. It carries an extra benefit, as we've talked about. But only 30% of non-STEM MBA programs are considering making that change. So clearly, I don't know if they just see that as more of a game-playing exercise rather than a true benefit for potential incoming students. Obviously, domestic students are not impacted by this, but a lot of graduate MBA programs tend to be heavily, particularly those campus-based graduate MBA programs, the online ones typically are not populated heavily by international students, but the seated campus programs are certainly going to be more attractive to international students if there's a STEM benefit to it. So those that are perhaps the 30% of non-STEM MBA programs who are not considering, or the 70% of non-STEM MBA programs that are not considering the move, those are probably ones that are are either shutting up shop on their campus-based MBA programs and going completely online, or executive MBAs. They're not focused on the international market anymore. Maybe that's their reasoning. But if you still have a seated component to your graduate MBA programs, graduate business programs, to not be looking at STEM, reclassifying a STEM, is silly. It's counterintuitive to your survival as a program, as a graduate program in these days. So if you have that seated program, again, not everybody does. There are a lot of prominent programs have been going more all exclusively online. So this is going to be a real challenge moving forward. But it's an opportunity to reclassify and to make yourself more attractive to overseas audiences, which can make up a large percentage of your population if you market it right, if you plan right. It can be a very diverse class of incoming students from particular countries that will see great value in that extra 2 years of work experience. So talking about graduate, we saw the pieces of it in the immigration legislation. We see the CGS numbers from last fall showing there's a real drop, and it's especially heightened in the science and technology programs. But we look at the bigger picture of why that happened last fall and what programs can be doing for the future is that there's only one way that numbers are going to go in 2021, and that is up. And that's a guarantee for me, because you know that it can't get worse with 40% drops in graduate enrollments, 43% overall in international enrollments. That's a significant chunk. And that was because 90% of embassies and consulates weren't open. And it was physically impossible, particularly in top sending countries, India, China, to even get a visa appointment. So we're going to see a rebounding. There is that pent-up interest we've been talking about for months, and it is going to manifest itself in fall enrollments. That's just going to happen. Take that one to the bank. Now, when we shift gears for this last topic of last question of the week, it's more of a philosophical question that we're asking, and we are asking it as, are you failing to prepare in international student matters, or are you preparing to fail? And basically, that's what that means. It's a famous Benjamin Franklin quote: "By failing to prepare, you are preparing to fail." And that is something that, as I've developed, I've talked many times over the last few months about my new philosophy when it comes to strategic international enrollment management of the six P's of SIEM. And the series that I'm doing for IDP Connect kind of encapsulates this philosophy in terms of where we are in how I think institutions should be approaching international enrollment management, and by thinking strategically. By, as we talked about last month, we talked about having that perspective on what's happening globally, what's happening on your campus, synthesizing those two into messaging for your students. That needs to be a foundational piece to anything you do, international student recruitment. And not just the recruitment piece, but also the student experience throughout their time on your campus. Not just from basically prospect to alumni, not just prospect to admitted or enrolled. It's the focus should be, with enrollment management, this is a concept that's been around since the 70s, mid-70s, when it started at Boston College. It's a philosophy that is very much data-driven. It's analytical in nature by having benchmarks for yield, for retention rates, for graduation rates, 4 and 5 year graduation rates. All of that came out of the enrollment management movement. And many schools have the admissions within enrollment management, may not have all the elements or of the student experience also in enrollment management. And that's kind of what and very few actually have undergraduate focused strategic, international focused strategic enrollment management plans. They might have an admissions plan for a year or two, but they don't have an international one that is a cradle to or a prospect to alumni enrollment management plan. And that's where I'm going with this, is talking about the second P of the six P's, and that is planning. And in my most recent article for IDP Connect, I talk about why planning is so invaluable in taking a big picture view of how your campus views international students. And again, it's not just our international enrollment numbers in the strategic plan for the institution. And if they are, then you build your enrollment management plan for international around that, at least on the front end. But you're also talking about the student experience, and should be talking about the student experience. I'm doing some work with some colleges now that are trying to put together a plan. They have a strategic plan for their institutions, but are trying to do something specifically around international. And what that means, it's not an easy process, frankly, because when you look at the way the student experience is divided up on many campuses, you're going to have admissions in one area, you're going to have student services in another, you're going to have financial aid, student employment in another, you're going to have registrars, you're going to have career services, you're going to have alumni, potentially in 4 or 5 different areas are under four or five different VPs on a given college campus. So when that happens, there oftentimes tends to be a siloed approach to student services or the student experience. And that presents a real challenge for a smooth transition for students throughout their time on your campus, before they arrive to after they've departed and have become alumni, of understanding who do I talk to for this, where do I go for that, and an understanding on campus that when you talk about enrollment management and services that are provided to make that a seamless transition from application to enrollment to advising to accessing student services to involving yourself on campus to preparing for jobs after graduation to becoming an alumni and what that means. And being tracked or even known by your college as an alum when you go back home. That's something that I think so many colleges don't really get and don't really plan for when it comes to an enrollment management plan for international students. They might have it for overall students, but there's so many issues international students face that the general strategic enrollment management plans do not have. They often get missed or swept under the table or paid short shrift. So for what I talk about is in my article and when I talk about planning, the importance of planning is taking a multi-year approach, taking a multi-level approach where you're working not just with admissions, you're working with student services. Those are the first two, if you don't have both of those working together, then forget about the rest. Once you start with those two and you can add in campus professionals development, career services, whatever that office would be named on your campus, and add in alumni. Those two, career services and alumni, tend to be the parts of that international student journey that are the least well connected to the overall experience. Because you, in the end, you want your students to be successful. You want them to get jobs. You want them to be, when they become alumni, to be great representatives of your institution and people that you can call on to for testimonials, for being involved in admitted student events if they're back home. All of these things are, that's if you're doing it right and you have it well planned and you have those features built into your plans, that can only help you on the front end. And it's like what we're talking about with the green card issues, that if this immigration regulation gets passed, this bill gets passed, and what that will do, because even though they're back end benefits, what that's going to do for the front end recruitment piece. And that's what we're talking about when we're talking about planning here, is having that kind of full cycle approach to a prospect through alumni and everywhere in between, having a plan for that experience and leveraging different components of that plan to make sure that they're all pointing towards an international student success model. And whatever that looks like on your campus, it's going to be different for everybody. But by using some basics that we, most of us who've done a strategic plan will know, is you got to have your goals, measurable goals, specific goals, achievable goals, realistic and time sensitive goals, SMART goals, really, which we've talked about before. And this approach is not new, but it is something that precious few colleges are doing well internationally. And this is a way that you're setting yourself up. If you've got institutional targets that say, all right, if you're fortunate enough to be at a campus that values international enough where it says, okay, we want to grow our international presence from 1% where it is now to 5% in the next 5 years, what does that mean on your campus? You have to go up 1% a year. Year two, you need to be at 2%. Year three, 4%, 3%. Whatever the measures you decide internally you need to be at, that's where you want to be moving towards. So that is going to impact what you do in terms of, all right, there's the goal. How do we build back year three, year one? Where do we need to be in our recruitment planning to achieve that goal? And again, multi-level, multi-year approach. Then also, it's got to have eventually when you have incredible data sources available, and I've talked about those in the past. I won't go into those now, but the link to the planning article does have those references, all the articles I've written, those sources that are available that need to be foundational in your why you go, where you go, the data-driven approach to student recruitment. Is country level planning, because you have target markets and those target markets are based on, well, they're sending the most students here. We have great relationships in these countries that might not be top 10 countries, but they're great for us as an institution. We have a solid base from those countries, recent alumni from those countries that will be that are successful and we hope to be supporting. That country level approach has to happen if you're going to do it well, rather than just take a shotgun approach to the entire planet. That's not the best, most effective way to leverage your efforts. And not every country needs to hear the same messages. So having that's built into messaging eventually as well. And that's something that you want to certainly include in any planning exercises that you're doing. And building in some reviews, because you look at this last year, what it's taught us is best laid plans get thrown out when, as Mike Tyson famously said, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face. COVID-19 punched everybody in the face in terms of the institutional impact, the global impact it's had. 500,000 people dead in the United States as a result of COVID. Tens of thousands of higher ed staff and faculty have lost their positions in the last year. So that's an incredible punch in the face. How are you adapting? You obviously had to remove all your recruitment online in March and April when that first came down. Obviously classes all went online. Campuses have had to adapt, but if you don't have processes built in to make that transition happen and to adjust the way you do things, then it's missed opportunities. And one last piece that related to this on how significant COVID-19's impact has been on international ed. You look at companies that have done tours or recruitment events, physical recruitment events for years. You're seeing some of them, those that are planning to survive, have moved into the virtual space and have done virtual events and many of them are hoping to get back to those physical events someday. Don't know when that's going to happen, but you look at a company like FPP, Edumedia down in Latin America. They have now made the commitment. They just had a Pi webinar last week that they are no longer going to do physical events when and if they can return to that. They've gone all in on virtual, and they've developed their own platform to make that happen, to provide the kind of experience that will be, in their minds, economically more viable for students, environmentally and time-saving benefits for the campuses are going to be that's their model moving forward. They've ditched in-person events in the future, even after it's okay to do them again. And their approach has been it's maybe not the most responsible thing to do anymore. So we'll see how many other institutions make those decisions. We'll certainly talk more as those develop in the months and weeks to come. But for now, I do want to say thank you to everyone who's taking time out there of the week to listen in or watch on repeat or live the midweek roundup. It's a real pleasure for me to be a part of your weekly edification in international ed and sharing our thoughts on what's going on. And we'll certainly be in touch in the weeks and months to come on next steps for a lot of these major issues. So until then, have a wonderful week, and we'll talk to you soon. Cheers.